Welcome back, everybody. My name is Dick, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Mary. I'm an alcoholic. This is Session 7, Chapter 7, Working with Others. Before we start, let's do the set-aside prayer.
God, please let me set aside everything I think I know about sobriety, life in you, so that I may be open to a new experience. Amen. So, let's start with Chapter 7, Working with Others. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. So why would people in AA say, don't do any 12-step work for the first year? Why would they tell them to not do the one thing that is most likely to ensure immunity from drinking? I don't understand why people would do that. It may be not doing it alone, maybe working with your sponsor, but this is the one thing that is going to most likely prevent us from drinking.
It tells us it works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. Notice they've got an exclamation mark at the end of that.
They don't do that very often. This is pretty important.
So this is the first part of the 12th step. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill.
Why can you help when no one else can? Well, no, you can't BS a drunk. We know when somebody knows what they're talking about, and so that's what it means. I can get an attention of another alcoholic in a matter of minutes, where it would take a non-alcoholic days, weeks, months, or not at all.
And one of the reasons is because we've done the exact same things they've done. We've walked in their shoes, and we now have an opportunity to show them how to recover. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives.
So we get our friends in AA from the people that we carry the message to, from the people that we 12-step, and as opposed to the casual acquaintances that we make inside of the AA meeting. Our true kinship with our fellow human beings comes as the result of working steps with another alcoholic.
Perhaps you're not acquainted with any drinkers who want to recover.
Key caveat in that sentence is who want to recover. A lot of us know a lot of drinkers, but it's whether they want to recover or not.
You can easily find some by asking a few doctors, ministers, priests, or hospitals.
So today, we don't need to necessarily go to those people or those places. We can find people who want to alcoholics who want to recover in AA meetings. It's a wonderful place. We've already sort of pre-cleared them, but they obviously have a desire to stop drinking. If they're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, they realize something's wrong, and we can find them there. However, their suggestion of find some by asking doctors, ministers, priests, or hospitals is a very good way to help to find new people for AA. And we can go to detox facilities. It's another place to find them.
As a matter of fact, I actually have told my dentist and my doctor that I'm a member of AA, and should they have anybody who wants to recover from alcoholism, I would be happy to talk with them. Our general service office through the AA World Service actually publishes pamphlets directly targeting doctors, priests, ministers, that we can also carry to those people, just so they understand who we are and what we are able to do. Don't start out as an evangelist or reformer.
So they've not a lot of places in this book do they tell us things to not do. And this is one of them. And this came as a result of some real hard knock experience on the part of Bill Wilson. Bill spent the first 6 months dragging people off the bar stools. And he was very, very preachy. Bill was kind of a preachy guy. And he would talk down to these people. And he would go, you know, trying to look for these alcoholics to help for the first 6 months of his sobriety. And it just, nothing was happening. He wasn't able to do anything. And he went to see Dr. Silkworth just before he made his business trip to Akron, Ohio. And the doctor said, Bill, don't preach to them. Explain the disease as I have explained it to you
also known as the doctor's opinion in our book, and then offer them help. Offer them the opportunity to see themselves and to work the steps.
In other words, share your experience, strength, and hope.
And so the very next person Bill calls on is Dr. Bob Smith. And it works. This is how we learned this experience, this information. Don't start out as an evangelist or reformer. Why? Because it doesn't work.
Unfortunately, a lot of prejudice or old ideas exist. You will be handicapped if you arouse it. Ministers and doctors are competent, and you can learn much from them if you wish. But it happens that because of your own drinking experience, you can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. So cooperate, never criticize. To be helpful is our only aim. When you discover a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, find out all you can about him. If he does not want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him.
So I ask that question at some point during an initial 12-step call. Are you interested in stopping?
If he says no, they give us permission not to waste time. Mm-hmm. You may spoil a later opportunity. This advice is given for his family also. They should be patient, realizing they are dealing with a sick person. If there is any indication that he wants to stop, have a good talk with the person most interested in him, usually his wife.
We don't do a lot of that anymore in this day and age, in the 21st century. A lot of times it's because people come to us and the marriages and the relationships have already been killed. There is no wife around. There's no parents. I mean, the guy is on his own. So we don't have an opportunity to do that kind of thing anymore.
Get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his background, the seriousness of his condition, and of his religious leaning.
And he can give us that. He or she, the person we're calling on, can give us that information.
You need this information to put yourself in his place to see how you would like him to approach you if the tables were turned. Sometimes it's wise to wait until he goes on a binge. The family may object to this, but unless he is in a dangerous physical condition, it is better to risk it. Don't deal with him when he is very drunk, unless he is ugly and the family needs your help. Wait for the end of the spree, or at least for a lucid interval. Then let his family or a friend ask him if he wants to quit for good, and if he would go to any extreme to do so. If he says yes, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. You should be described to him as one of a fellowship who is part of their own recovery, try to help others, and who will be glad to talk to him if he cares to see you. If he does not want to see you, never force yourself upon him.
So that's kind of acting as a reformist or an evangelist. If you don't, people who don't want to talk to us, we don't talk to. It's just, you know, simple. We're not going to be evangelistic about this.
Neither should the family hysterically plead with him to do anything, nor should they tell him much about you. They should wait for the end of his next drinking bout. You might place this book where he can see it in the interval.
Well, there's a subtle hint.
Here, no specific rule can be given. The family must decide these things, but urge them not to be over-anxious, for that might spoil matters. Usually, the family should not try to tell your story. When possible, avoid meeting a man through his family.
Well, we just read a page and a half about meeting him through the family, and now we're told it's not the best way. But, okay.
Approach through a doctor or an institution is a better bet. If your man needs hospitalization, he should have it.
Now, what they mean by hospitalization, let's not forget, this is a 3 to 5 day detoxification. It is a detoxifying from alcohol is a serious medical condition, and we do need to have medical supervision. But it's 3 to 5 days. It's not a full-blown 30-day kind of thing in a treatment center.
And remember, this was written in 1939 before there was even anything called a detox, so in fact they were in a hospital.
Right.
Let the doctor, if he will, tell him he has something in the way of a solution. When your man is better, the doctor might suggest a visit from you.
This assumes that you've had a really good conversation with the doctor, that he knows about you, that you've established a relationship with him. If you haven't, you're probably not going to have this kind of help from a doctor.
Though you have talked with the family, leave them out of the first discussion. Under these conditions, your prospect will see he is under no pressure. He will feel he can deal with you without being nagged by his family. Call on him while he is still jittery. It's kind of the way Ebby called on Bill.
Mm-hmm.
He may be more receptive when depressed.
see your man alone, if possible. Well, wait a minute. They just kept talking about how we're going to see him through with a doctor and all that other stuff. And we never go on a 12-step call alone. What they mean by that is see your man without the family. We tend to do, if we're going to do a real-life 12-step call, if we're going to go actually visiting people in their homes and so on, we never go alone. It's a safety thing. And when I park on a dead brain cell, the person I'm with can pick up the conversation. So it's just easier. At first, engage in general conversation. After a while, turn the talk to some phase of drinking. Tell him enough about your drinking habits, symptoms, and experiences to encourage him to speak of himself. If he wishes to talk, let him do so. You will thus get a better idea how you ought to proceed.
So there's mood one, the talkative mood.
If he's not communicative, give him a sketch of your drinking career up to the time you quit, but say nothing for the moment of how that was accomplished.
So there's mood two, the not communicative mood.
If he's in a serious mood,
mood three,
dwell on the troubles liquor has caused you, being careful not to moralize or lecture. And if his mood is light,
mood four,
tell him humorous stories of your escapades. Tell him to get some of his, get him to tell some of his. When he sees you know all about the drinking game, commence to describe yourself as an alcoholic. Tell him how baffled you were, how you finally learned that you were sick. Where did you learn that? In the doctor's opinion. Give him a count of the struggles you made to stop. Show him the mental twist which leads to the first drink of a spree. We suggest you do this as we have done in the chapter on alcoholism, the chapter called More About Alcoholism. If he's alcoholic, he'll understand at once. He will match your mental inconsistencies with some of his own. If you are satisfied he's a real alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady or the problem. Show him from your own experience how the queer mental condition surrounding that first drink prevents normal functioning of the willpower.
The word queer means odd.
Don't, at this stage, refer to this book unless he's seen it and wishes to discuss it. That was probably true in the 1930s. In the 21st century, lots and lots and lots and lots of people have heard of AA, but they don't really know what it is. They've heard about it from people who don't understand our 12 steps, who don't understand this book. And so I do refer to the book, and I do discuss it, and I talk about the fact that it is our program, and it's different from many other programs out there, and also much more successful. Back to the book. And be careful not to brand him as an alcoholic. Let him draw his own conclusions. If he sticks to the idea that he can still control his drinking, tell him that possibly he can if he's not too alcoholic, but insist that if he's severely afflicted, there may be little chance he can recover by himself. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady.
Meaning it can kill.
Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it.
And, of course, we learned about that from the doctor's opinion, the twofold nature of our malady.
Keep us, and if we're going to talk about the twofold nature, we have to be careful about talking about the craving because it's not well understood in the general public. The word craving is used very differently in the 1930s and in this book than it is today. So we've got to make sure we understand it's a physical craving.
Mm-hmm. Keep its attention focused mainly on your personal experience. Explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. Doctors are rightly loath to tell alcoholic patients the whole story unless it will serve some good purpose.
Why would that be?
Well, I don't think the doctor has the solution, so why tell him how that would affect him? But you may talk to him about the hopelessness of alcoholism because you offer a solution.
So a doctor doesn't have a solution, and we do.
You will soon have your friend admitting he has many, if not all, of the traits of the alcoholic. If his own doctor is willing to tell him that he is alcoholic, so much the better. Even though your protege may not have entirely admitted his condition, he has become very curious to know how you got well.
So in this book, they refer to the person that we're calling on as a prospect, a friend, a protege, and a candidate. Never is he referred to as a, quote, pigeon, which is a term I don't much care for.
Or a sponsee.
Or a sponsee, or any of those kinds of things. He's a friend. He's a prospect. He's somebody who may need our program. He's a protege.
Let him ask you that question, if he will.
Let's review what the question is.
How did you get well?
Mm-hmm.
Tell him exactly what happened to you. Stress the spiritual feature freely. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic that he does not have to agree with your own conception of God.
Notice that that's in squiggly writing. So we have to make sure that we bring forward the information on page 29 where they said when we refer to God, it wasn't 29, I've got the wrong
page.
When
Abby first of all tells Bill, why don't you choose your own concept of God, and then when we're in the section on step two, they allow us again to understand that we are not going to force our own conception of God on them.
And so on page 47, I had the wrong page, but it says, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. So we need to make sure that we tell this person that. We're not there to carry a religious message. We're there to carry a spiritual message. So, it says, make it emphatic. If the man be an agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. I think that pertains to everyone that we carry the message to. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. Squiggly writing here again, they want us to pay attention. The main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself, and that he live by spiritual principles.
When dealing with such a person, you had better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There's no use arising any prejudice he may have against certain theological terms and conceptions about which he may already be confused. Don't raise such issues no matter what your own convictions are.
So using specific religious terms, Jesus, Muhammad, all of those kinds of things, they tell us, don't raise such issues no matter what your own convictions are. You're going to turn somebody away if they think we're trying to carry a religious message.
Your prospect may belong to a religious denomination. His religious education and training may be far superior to yours. In that case, he's going to wonder how you can add anything to what he already knows. But he will be curious to learn why his own convictions have not worked and why yours seem to work so well.
That brings to mind, in my mind, a story of one of the men that I work with in the correction facility area. We take meetings to correctional facilities, and he tells the story that he once, at one time, sponsored a Catholic bishop. Now, I'm suspecting that he couldn't tell the Catholic bishop anything about his religion, but he was able to explain our spiritual exercises that we have in this program,
which allow us to establish a personal relationship with our higher power.
Right.
He may be an example of the truth that faith alone is insufficient. To be vital or life-giving, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. Let him see that you're not there to instruct him in religion. Admit that he probably knows more about it than you do, but call to his attention the fact that however deep his faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it, or he would not drink. Perhaps your story will help him see where he has failed to practice the very precepts he knows so well. We represent no particular faith or denomination. We are dealing only with the general principles common to most denominations. Outline the program of action.
So that's in the book.
Meaning we've done the action, mm-hmm. explaining how you made a self-appraisal.
Step four.
How you straightened out your past.
Step nine.
And why you're now endeavoring to be helpful to him.
Step 12.
It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery.
So the beginning part of this chapter, they said that nothing is going to ensure immunity as much as intensive work with other alcoholics. Here we are again. This plays a vital part in your own recovery. Vital means life-giving.
Actually, he may be helping you more than you are helping him. Make it plain he is under no obligation to you, that you hope only that he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties.
So I've been on hundreds of 12-step calls. I've been sober for a lot of years, and I've had the wonderful opportunity of doing lots of real-life 12-step calls. They've all been 100% successful. I've never had a failure, ever. Wow. I have stayed sober. That's why I do the 12-step work. Make it plain that he's under no obligation And he actually may be helping you more than you're helping him. That's been the case in my experience always. I get more out of a 12-step call than anyone else.
So again, they're emphasizing, make sure that he understands that we're wanting him to help other alcoholics when he eventually escapes his own difficulties.
Right.
Suggest how important it is that he place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. Make it clear that he is not under pressure, that he needn't see you again if he doesn't want to. You should not be offended if he wants to call it off, for he's helped you more than you have helped him. If your talk has been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, you have perhaps made a friend.
There's a guideline for our conversation with the people.
Maybe you have disturbed him about the question of alcoholism. This is all to the good. The more hopeless he feels, the better. He will be more likely to follow your suggestions. Your candidate may give reasons why he need not follow all of the program.
Mm-hmm.
He may rebel at the thought of a drastic house cleaning.
Step 4.
Which requires discussion with other people.
Step 5.
Do not contradict such views. Tell him you once felt as he did, as he does, but you doubt whether you would have made much progress had you not taken action. I'm laughing because when I got sober, I went to a meeting and somebody stood up and said, I did my 4th step. However, I'm holding myself in readiness to do my 5th step, but I did my 4th step 10 years ago. And I thought, oh, that's great. I'll just hold off. Well, that wasn't what the person who was taking me through the steps thought. On your first visit, tell them about the fellowship, notice that's capitalized, of Alcoholics Anonymous.
So we're going to talk to them about the worldwide organization of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what that means. So you've got X number of meetings in your area. They're held all day and night. Tell them the kinds of meetings that we have members all over the world, that we're 2.5 million and growing members around the world, and so on and so forth. Those are the kinds of things that we're going to explain to them. Not about the lowercase fellowship, the friendship. We're not there yet.
If he shows interest, lend him your copy of this book.
Well, you know, when this book was written, the cost of the book was $3.50. If you calculate what that would be worth in 21st century money, it would be about $45. So they did loan their books around. A book was very expensive. Today they're, what, $10 or something of that nature, $10, $12? So I just buy a few extra and have them in my trunk and I give them away. I can afford to do that. If the person's working for you can go take him to a meeting and he can buy one at a meeting. I don't lend out my copy of the book.
One of the ideas behind that might be because you'd have to meet him again to get your book back.
Yeah.
Another opportunity for conversation.
There you go.
Unless your friend wants to talk further about himself, do not wear out your welcome. Give him a chance to think it over. If you do stay, let him steer the conversation in any direction he likes. Sometimes a new man is anxious to proceed at once, and you may be tempted to let him do so. This is sometimes a mistake. If he has trouble later, he is likely to say you rushed him. You will be most successful with alcoholics if you did not exhibit any passion for crusade or reform.
So this business about wants to proceed at once, where I hear a lot of that is people who have, men who, I sponsor men, so I'll talk about men, who have been through some sort of treatment or rehab center, and they think they've already done steps 1, 2, 3, and maybe more. What I have found is that, as they say in the book, this is sometimes a mistake. They don't necessarily get the way we do the first, second, third step in the book. So it's important that we give them the AA 12 steps, not necessarily what went on in a treatment center rehab, because we don't know what went on in that treatment center.
And I've had the same experience where people will say, Mary, I've been through all 5 steps, and I'd like to start at 6 with you. And, of course, when I first did that, wow, what a mistake. We ended up cycling back to 1 again when the person had their slip. Mm-hmm. So I've learned also, you will be most successful with alcoholics if you do not exhibit any passion for crusade or reform. Never talk down to an alcoholic from any moral or spiritual hilltop.
We talk to them as equals.
Simply lay out the kit of spiritual tools for his inspection.
That's the 12 steps, is the spiritual tools.
Show him how they worked with you. Offer him friendship and fellowship. Tell him that if he wants to get well, you will do anything to help. One thing I've been told by my sponsor, and I've had to learn through mistakes, is I'm also not going to work harder at their sobriety than they do. I will do anything to help, but they need to be willing to do the work themselves. If he is not interested in your solution, if he expects you to act only as a banker for his financial difficulties or a nurse for his sprees, you may have to drop him until he changes his mind. This he may do after he gets hurt some more. If he is sincerely interested and wants to see you again, ask him to read this book in the interval.
So I don't do that. This is the one thing in this book that I don't do. And the reason I don't is twofold. Number one, a lot of alcoholics don't read well when they come to AA. I could not, when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't either read nor write. I had alcoholic neuropathy. I think I mentioned all of that in the beginning. So I was unable to read. So if you told me to read the book, I would have BS'd my way through it, number one. Number two, the language, as we've seen through this exercise, is very different. It takes some explanation. It takes the glossaries that we've provided to you online. So I don't ask them to read the book. We read the book together. I read the book because, as you can see, both Mary and I interrupt our reading here. If you do that too much and the new person is reading, they will take offense to it. So I sit at my kitchen table and read the book.
After doing that, he must decide for himself whether he wants to go on. He should not be pushed or prodded by you, his wife, or his friends. If he is to find God, the desire must come from within. If he thinks he can do the job in some other way or prefers some other spiritual approach, encourage him to follow his own conscience. We have no monopoly on God. We merely have an approach that worked with us. But point out that we alcoholics have much in common and that you would like in any case to be friendly. Let it go with that. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again.
We are responsible for carrying the message, not responsible for it being heard.
You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. So once again, that allows us to move on if the person is not desperate for what we have to offer and share our experience, strength, and hope with someone who is.
I leave my phone number with them when I move on, and sometimes I get a call sometimes months or years later.
Yes. I always say call me when you're ready so that they don't feel that we're just going to sever all connections. One of our fellowship failed entirely with his first half dozen prospects.
They're referring to Bill Wilson.
He often says that if he had continued to work on them, he might have deprived many others who have since recovered of their chance. Suppose now you're making your second visit to a man.
So the 12th step is not just one visit, it's more than one visit.
He has read this volume and says he is prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. Having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. Let him know you are available if he wishes to make a decision.
Step three.
And tell his story.
Step five.
But do not insist upon it if he prefers to consult someone else. He may be broke and homeless. If he is, you might try to help him about getting a job or give him a little financial assistance.
Here's a big caveat here, though.
But you should not deprive your family or creditors of money they should have. Perhaps you will want to take the man into your home for a few days.
Well, we don't do much of that anymore. We used to do that a lot, especially in the 1930s. But today we have so many social service agencies that can provide housing, that can arrange for people to stay in shelters and that kind of thing. So we just don't need to do that anymore. But it still does occur from time to time.
But be sure you use discretion. Be certain he will be welcomed by your family.
So that means you got to have a conversation with your family.
And that he is not trying to impose upon you for money, connections, or shelter.
So that gives you permission to not do it if you believe that's the case.
And if you don't have the conversation, I can tell you from experience that it causes a bit of a trouble in a relationship. So when Dick's sponsor asked him to take a gentleman into his home from the workhouse prior to us being married, Dick forgot to have the conversation with this gentleman about when he would be leaving.
Then I couldn't get rid of him. He was like a...
So it was the week of our marriage, and we're sweeping this poor guy off the front step because it's time.
And anyway. He's been there a year and a half.
All right. So permit that, and you only harm him, meaning if they're just trying to hit you up for money or connections or shelter. Mm-hmm. You will be making it possible for him to be insincere. You may be aiding in his destruction rather than his recovery. Never avoid these responsibilities, but be sure you are doing the right thing if you assume them. Helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery.
So it's a big part of our of this whole recovery. It's the foundation stone of our recovery, doing this 12-step work.
A kindly act once in a while isn't enough. You have to act the Good Samaritan every day if need be. It may mean the loss of many nights' sleep, great interference with your pleasures, interruptions to your business. It may mean sharing your money in your home, counseling frantic wives and relatives, innumerable trips to police courts, sanitariums, hospitals, jails, and asylums. Your telephone may jangle at any time of the day or night. Your wife may sometimes say she is neglected. A drunk may smash the furniture in your home or burn a mattress. You may have to fight with him if he is violent. Sometimes you'll have to call a doctor and administer sedatives under his direction. Another time, you may have to send for the police or an ambulance. Occasionally, you will have to meet such conditions.
So those are not everyday kinds of things. They're once in a while.
And this is the price of peace of mind. Mm-hmm. These are our obligations. We seldom allow an alcoholic to live in our homes for long at a time.
That's the chapter, the sentence that I forgot to read before.
It is not good for him, and it sometimes creates serious complications in a family. Though an alcoholic does not respond, there is no reason why you should neglect his family. You should continue to be friendly to them. The family should be offered your way of life.
So the way I do that in the 21st century is we have an Al-Anon central office, an intergroup in the city we live in. And so I have a bunch of their business cards, and I carry them with me. So when I come across a family member, I suggest they might want to look into the Al-Anon family groups. And so I give them one of those cards so they can get a meeting schedule and get that kind of information.
Should they accept and practice spiritual principles, there is a much better chance that the head of the family will recover. And even though he continues to drink, the family will find life more bearable. For the type of alcoholic who is able and willing to get well, little charity in the ordinary sense of the word is needed or wanted. The men who cry for money and shelter before conquering alcohol are on the wrong track. Yet we do go to great extremes to provide each other with these very things when such action is warranted. This may seem inconsistent, but we think it is not. It is not the matter of giving that is in question, but when and how to give. That often makes the difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on a service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God.
So there's a bit of confusion in our 21st century about that section of the book, because we think of service as a good thing. We get involved in general service, or we get involved in local service with our intergroup or central office, and it's confusing to us. What they mean is when I start to put my work on being of service to the alcoholic, giving him rides, buying, making sure he's got coffee at meetings, then they begin to rely on us. And so I'm not trying to do the work for him, or in my case, him. Rather, I'm trying to get them to work the steps. So it's confusing to us. And now that when we're talking about service, let's be clear about what 12-step work is. 12-step work is one-on-one working with or talking to another alcoholic. A lot of people I hear in AA saying, well, I do my service work by being the coffee maker, or I do my 12-step work by being the chair setter-upper. That is not 12-step work. It's service work. It makes 12-step work possible. We need to have a good meeting place. We need to have refreshments at meetings and so on. But it is providing an opportunity for 12-step work. It does not take the place of 12-step work. Service work's important, but it isn't 12-step work.
He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for.
Listen to this.
Nonsense.
Nonsense.
Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn the truth. job or no job, wife or no job, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence upon God. Bring the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is the trust in God and clean house.
So we've up to now had some instructions for us doing the 12-step work. Now we're going to get some instructions for the prospect here.
Now the domestic problem. There may be divorce, separation, or just strained relations. When your prospect has made such reparation as he can to his family, meaning done his ninth step, and has thoroughly explained to them the new principles by which he is living, he should proceed to put those principles into action at home.
So notice that he's done the work. Now he's going to start doing living amends, put those principles into action at home.
That is, if he is lucky enough to have a home. Though his family be at fault in many respects, he should not be concerned about that. He should concentrate on his own spiritual demonstration. So not talking about it, but showing us through his actions. Argument and fault finding are to be avoided like the plague. In many homes, this is a difficult thing to do, but it must be done if any results are to be expected. If persisted in for a few months, the effect on a man's family is sure to be great. The most incompatible people discover they have a basis upon which they can meet. Little by little, the family may see their own defects and admit them. These can then be discussed in an atmosphere of friendliness.
After they have seen tangible results, the family will perhaps want to go along. These things will come to pass naturally and in good time, provided, however, the alcoholic continues to demonstrate that he can be sober, considerate, and helpful, regardless of what anyone says or does. Of course, we fall much below this standard many times, but we must try to repair the damage immediately, lest we pay the penalty by a spree, a reference to the 10th step there. If there be divorce or separation, there should be no undue haste for the couple to get together. The man should be sure of his recovery. The wife should fully understand his new way of life. If their old relationship is to be resumed, it must be on a better basis since the former did not work. This means a new attitude and spirit all around. Sometimes it's to the best interest of all concerned that the couple remain apart. Obviously, no rule can be laid down. Let the alcoholic continue his program day by day. When the time for living together has come, it will be apparent to both parties. Let no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. It just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another. Remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It's dependent upon his relationship with God. We have seen men get well whose families have not returned at all, and we've seen others slip when the family came back too soon. So now we're going to get some instructions here for both of us, for the new man or the new person and us. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances.
When working with a man and his family, you should take care not to participate in their quarrels. You may spoil your chance of being helpful if you do. But urge upon a man's family that he has been a very sick person and should be treated accordingly. You should warn against arousing resentment or jealousy. You should point out that his defects of character are not going to disappear overnight. Show them that he has entered upon a period of growth. Ask them to remember, when they are impatient, the blessed fact of his sobriety. If you have been successful in solving your own domestic problems, tell the newcomer's family how that was accomplished.
If you have not been successful in that regard, don't say anything.
In this way, you can set them on the right track without becoming critical of them. The story of how you and your wife settled your difficulties is worth any amount of criticism. Assuming, this is a big if, we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes. We must not go into bars. Our friends must hide their bottles if we go to their houses. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There is something the matter with his spiritual status.
Go back to the beginning and start over.
His only chance for sobriety would be someplace like the Greenland ice cap, and even there, an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. Ask any woman who has sent her husband to distant places on the theory he would escape the alcohol problem. In our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. We have tried these methods. These attempts to do the impossible have always failed. So our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking if we have a legitimate reason for being there.
So you remember the story of Jim the car guy back in More About Alcoholism? Jim was going to that bar for all during the time he was sober, by himself, not taking customers there or anything of that nature. That is not a legitimate reason. There are probably lots of restaurants that serve the same kind of lunch that Jim wanted to eat that didn't have a bar in it. So that's a big caveat. That's why it's in italics. If we have a legitimate reason for being there.
That includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, weddings, even plain ordinary whoopee parties.
You got to be pretty old to know what a plain ordinary whoopee party is. It's where you just party down.
To a person who has had experience with an alcoholic, this may seem like tempting providence, but it isn't.
Providence is capitalized, so tempting God.
You will note that we have made an important qualification. So here's the test before you set out. Therefore, ask yourself on each occasion, have I any good social, business, or personal reason for going to this place?
What do you think the answer to that would have been if Jim had asked himself that, Jim the car guy that would have asked himself that?
Or am I expecting to steal a little vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere of such places? If you answer these questions satisfactorily, you need have no apprehension. Go or stay away, whichever seems best. But be sure you're on solid spiritual ground before you start and that your motive in going is thoroughly good. Do not think of what you will get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring to it. But if you are shaky, you had better work with another alcoholic instead. Why sit with a long face in places where there is drinking, sighing aloud about the good old days? If it is a happy occasion, try to increase the pleasure of those there. If a business occasion, go and attend to your business enthusiastically. If you are with a person who wants to eat in a bar, by all means, go along. Let your friends know they are not to change their habits on your account. At a proper time and place, explain to all your friends why alcohol disagrees with you. If you do this thoroughly, few people will ask you to drink.
So when you're doing that with your friends and business associates, you're going to do that thoroughly. The way we're going to do that is to use Dr. Silkworth's opinion of the physical allergy coupled with the mental obsession. All we really need to explain to our friends is that we have a physical allergy. It's no different, really. Than somebody who has a peanut allergy. We don't even need to disclose our AA membership. We're just simply going to say that I can't drink because I have a physical allergy to alcohol. It's very easy, and I don't need to disclose my AA membership.
And at that point, you probably don't even need to go into the mental obsession part.
Right, exactly. They don't care about that.
While you were drinking, you were withdrawing from life little by little. Now you're getting back into the social life of this world. Don't start to withdraw again just because your friends drink liquor. You know, as you're looking at the questions that you're supposed to ask yourselves, it's also a good idea to run these situations by your sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
And I've received advice such as make sure you have your own transportation so that you can leave a situation. Make sure in the good old days that you had plenty of quarters for the payphone to call for help or just to talk to someone. So again, you can always use your sponsor or other experienced members in AA to help you decide in your early days of sobriety, especially whether or not you should go to some of these types of events.
That's why so many AA meetings have telephone lists.
Your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. Remember back on page 77, they also said our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. So again, they keep reiterating this point. So when we talk about you should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand, keep on the firing life of life with these motives and God will keep you unharmed.
Sordid means?
Really a not a good place. Let me look it up. I don't have it at the top of my head. And guess what? It's not there.
Oh, okay. Well,
sordid would be unsavory, scary.
Unsafe.
There you go.
So when we're going to sordid places, we're going to make sure that we have someone else with us and that we use common sense.
Oh, I found it. Dirty, filthy, wretched, squalid.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, many of us keep liquor in our homes. We often need it to carry green recruits through a severe hangover.
We don't do much of that anymore. When I first got sober, I was fortunate that I got sober in a part of the world where we were the firing line. The police department in this small town where I spent my first 4 years of sobriety had every one of our phone numbers, and if they got a D&D, a drunken disorderly, they would call us and we would take them to the hospital, which was about 50 miles away. And it was a wonderful opportunity, and we carried alcohol in our cars for them, carry a half pint of vodka. Because if you're driving down the road at 50 miles an hour and they see a liquor store that's open, they might well get out of the car at 50 miles an hour, so you got to have something. But we don't do much of that anymore.
And you had two other very special items.
We had an ice cream bucket, which we placed between the prospect's knees and sitting in the front seat, because if they have to throw up, in those days we had crank down windows, we didn't have electric windows, and it will end up all on the inside of your car. So you give them an ice cream bucket and a bottle of Karo, K-A-R-O,
syrup.
And I don't know what the purpose of that was. I'm told it settled the stomach some. I don't know if that's true or not, but we carried it.
Many of us keep liquor in our homes. We often need it to carry green recruits through a severe hangover. Some of us still serve it to our friends, provided they are not alcoholic. But some of us think we should not serve liquor to anyone. We never argue this question. We feel that each family, in the light of their own circumstances, ought to decide for themselves.
So you have a conversation about that with your family so that you can come to a conclusion, so you all know before the guests come as to what you're going to do.
So for us, when we entertain, we ask people to please bring the alcohol to our home if they would like to have wine or beer. But the condition is they must remove all bottles and cans when they leave. We're careful never to show intolerance or hatred of drinking as an institution. Experience shows that such an attitude is not helpful to anyone.
That's kind of a factor of the Prohibition era and during the Depression, so not so much anymore, but anyway.
Every new alcoholic looks for this spirit among us and is immensely relieved when he finds we're not witch burners. A spirit of intolerance might repel alcoholics whose lives could have been saved had it not been for such stupidity. We would not even do the cause of temperate drinking any good, for not one drinker in 1,000 likes to be told anything about alcohol by one who hates it. Someday we hope that Alcoholics Anonymous will help the public to a better realization of the gravity of the alcoholic problem. But we shall be of little use if our attitude is one of bitterness or hostility. Drinkers will not stand for it. After all, our problems were of our own making. Bottles were only a symptom. Besides, we have stopped fighting anybody or anything. We have to.
So we're going to stop here, and the next tape will be devoted to Chapter 11.